years, while also somehow managing to maintain a tenuous grasp on my sanity. I am used to an incredibly busy and fast-paced environment, serving as a personal assistant to 7 doctors, each with drastically different personalities and demands, as well as being an unpaid servant and chambermaid to literally thousands of wealthy suburbanites and their unruly pets. My duties included, but were never limited to, answering phones without an attitude, swallowing my pride while people talked down their noses to me about cat vaccines, feeling chagrined as clients made jokes like, "Brought you a present," while tossing steaming bags of dog feces for parasite screening on the desk next to my iced tea, getting bitten on the leg more than once without murdering anyone involved, staying awake for 11 hours at a stretch despite the 50 milligrams of Benadryl in my system because, believe it or not, I am allergic to stupid cats, sniff testing the effectiveness of industrial-strength, institutional-grade air fresheners against the smells released from animal mouths, butts, and inner ears, fielding questions like, "Why is there a worm coming out of my dog's penis?" Answer, that is his penis. Giving meticulously detailed driving directions to the practice over the telephone in 2016. Ordering enough office supplies to both cover the anticipated needs of the clinic and also offset the collateral damage inflicted upon the supply closet by the staff. Who needs 36 blue ballpoint pens in their house? I mean, who? Making playlists full of dope yet inoffensive mid-tempo jams as a subtle reminder that they had chosen a hospital with cool-ass motherfuckers working there, yet ones who are savvy enough to know that you can't have the word shit unbleeped during business hours. I'm very good at covertly grinding my teeth down to stumps as gentlemen who have clearly chased a soiled diaper with bitter espresso wheeze instructions on how to best do a job I have held for the entirety of my adult life directly into my face. And while my brain says, "Go kill yourself," my mask remains a placid lake of serenity whose surface remains unrippled despite the frothy rage boiling just beneath its surface. I am also exceptional at keeping a straight face at the same time a person asks, "Ugh, is this table clean?" while pointing in disgust at a sterilized table upon which she has been asked to set a creature who is enthusiastically licking its own asshole. Or when a man primed to spend upwards of $100 on pain pills for a dog complains about how much his 100% optional companion animal is costing him, despite his having paid 2,500 real American dollars to bring that purebred host to all manner of insect, arachnid, and parasite into his home. I excel at remaining outwardly calm on the telephone while women yell at me about cat dandruff on speakerphone from within the lush confines of their roomy Land Rovers. I'm totally able to keep a cool head as someone explains to me in a condescending tone how of course she can't come in to get redacted's flaky, dry skin checked out at 4:30. She has a job. Don't I know what having a work schedule is like? I'm superb at seeming interested in the 37th conversation of the day about the weather, or feigning surprise at how congested Main Street is on a Tuesday afternoon. I don't give a shit about traffic, or weather, or any combination thereof. Want to know what the last thing the hourly wage drone, trapped behind a desk in a windowless office for 11-plus hours, wants to hear from a person who clearly has a lot of in-the-middle-of-the-fucking-day free time on her hands? How beautiful it is outside, how gorgeous the clouds are, and how wonderful the air feels. Oh, You didn't have to wear a jacket today? Well, glory be, Diane. I don't care. For me, today is the same temperature-controlled 68 degrees it is every other goddamn day. Storm clouds, 68 degrees. Blizzard, still 68 degrees. I mean, sometimes I turn on the ceiling fan if I really want to feel like I'm living my best life, but even then it's still only 68 degrees with a light breeze. Dude, every day I dream of chewing my wrists open and emptying them until I'm dead. I really ought to get out and enjoy that sunshine. I get it. But then who would sell you your dog's outrageously priced limited protein food? I can and will answer to many names that aren't my own. Hello, Stephanie? Sabrina? Salmonella? Is that you? I have been referred to as the nice African-American woman on the phone more times than I can count, which is interesting because I am decidedly not nice. Mildly unpleasant would work just fine, I think. Speaking of my awful voice and face, even though a lot of Diane's have been looking at the same scowl for the past 14 years, 3 months, and handful of days, many of them think of me as their friend, which is surprising, even to me. And so, my friend-making under duress skills will obviously be an asset in my new position. I totally understand why watching this metamorphosis over the last decade would fool someone into thinking he knows me in real life. I scheduled their ragdoll's tooth surgery. I faxed their Bichon's Bordetella vaccine to the kennel. And sure, they often don't remember my name, but they've invited me out to lunch, dreading that I might take them up on it, asked me over to their actual houses for dinner, really, really dreading that I might wear my work jeans stinking of Rocal D into their homes, and on one special instance, paid for my books that one semester I decided I was going to finish my degree. Okay, that was actually amazing. The nice ones come in with boxes of chocolate and cases of beer and bottles of wine. Grateful that an adult woman who got a 33 on the ACT dedicated most of her life to explaining the difference between fleas and ticks to college freshmen who use their meal allotment money to buy corgi puppies from shady Craigslist breeders. One time, when I was in Whole Foods with a cart full of shit pretending to be rich, I ran into this woman who was so thankful that I talked her through getting her dog to vomit up the carcass of a squirrel the week before that she bought all of my groceries. I don't know why I'm resistant to say so, but I am actually quite good at serving a customer. Upon finding out that I work in an animal hospital, people are usually like, "Aw, you must love pets. Are all the puppies and kitties so cute?" And then they blink real hard and smile with all of their teeth showing, waiting for me to regale them with heartwarming stories of cats rescued from trees and dogs that save little boys who've fallen down the local well. They picture my day to be like Belle's in Beauty and the Beast, except instead of skipping through the French countryside, I'm limping through the suburbs, waving hello to the baker and the cobbler as they tip their caps while I struggle past, carrying a backpack full of a half-hearted attempt at lunch I already don't want to eat, and anxiety meds in lieu of a basket laden with library books, ruffling the heads of children I pass on their way to school. This imaginary hospital is little more than a modernized gingerbread house, purring kitties and floppy-eared dogs bounding after me with their bushy tails wagging as I flip on the lights and turn on the fans and cast open the shades to let the sunshine stream in. No animals are violent or in critical condition, and all of them are well-behaved enough to roam free, maybe alighting on my shoulder as I hand Mr. Martin his parcel of healing tonics and tinctures I've made myself, the price of which he wouldn't dream of haggling over. Cool breezes blow through open windows that no dog is actively trying to commit suicide through. And who needs doctors when the needles and blades just come to life and perform the operations themselves? In reality, I stumble through blinding snow from the train at 7:20 in the morning to the darkened door, grope blindly down the pitch-black hallway to find the keypad that shuts off the alarm, then have 30 seconds to enter the 4-digit code before those flashing lights and that awful siren start blaring, signaling that the police are on their way and I have to find something in this building other than my secret painkiller drawer to prove I actually work here. I spend 27 real seconds punching in various passcodes until one finally stops the ticking clock, then immediately bend at the waist to dry heave as the computerized voice bleeps, "Disarmed, ready to arm." I try to regain composure as I rummage through the communal fridge to find the Coke I swear I left in there, but give up when I hear voices approaching, shoving someone else's soda into my bag, swearing to myself that I will replace it as soon as the liquor store next door opens. When I get to my desk, the fax machine is shooting memos from various referral clinics by the dozen, and the phone's blinking red light indicates that 18 messages have been left in the 12 hours since we've last been around to answer the phones. Hospitalized patients, realizing that the box cleaners and food pourers have arrived to start their shifts, howl and yowl and caterwaul for their breakfasts. The place quickly fills with the brain-rattling noise of the day, the sharp clang of metal bowls in the waist-high tub/sink, the whoosh of water from the hose spraying down the outdoor runs, the slam of a washing machine filled with blankets and towels, treatment orders shouted over the din of bark and meow. I listen to the voicemails. Several hang-ups, a couple, "Hello? Is this the answering service? Hello? Hello? Jean, I told you they weren't open yet." And at least one, "No, I don't have an appointment, but I'm bringing my dog right when you open, and I want to be seen immediately. I don't care what else the doctor has coming in, just to get the stress adrenaline pumping." While trying to say good morning to coworkers as they answer emails and file lab work. By the time we unlock the doors, we've done so many things that it feels like the day should already be over. And then comes the constant deluge of impatient questions I may or may not have the answer to. Yes, I know the requirements for filling out an international health certificate for a cat to fly to Romania. No, I don't know whether your dog walker's advice to use cedar oil will get rid of a flea infestation. The hourly pop quiz of every single one of the prescription diets we carry and its indications, because if I sell Hill's AD to a person who really needs IAM's low residue, I could get in hot water. And the ungraceful mating dance that occurs when someone mindlessly talking on her cell phone has a pissed off, scared, snapping terrier raging at the end of a loosely held flexi leash as I'm trying to usher her into an exam room. I can translate the consistency of a dog's stool as relayed to me by its owner into the proper medical terminology. Soupy equals diarrhea. Watery equals diarrhea. Like a melted chocolate bar equals diarrhea. Kind of runny this morning, but lumpy by lunchtime equals diarrhea. You know, like vomit, but from her butt equals diarrhea. There are 7 doctors in our practice, which means that in addition to explaining surgery consent forms and the difference between each of the dangerous vectors that can bite and infect a dog and the products we carry to protect them, I have to be a personal assistant to one dude who likes his messages time-stamped and dated and listed in order of importance, and a woman who prefers to be tracked down and delivered her messages by hand, plus 5 other people. I just interviewed a young woman who responded to the blunt and very direct ad I posted to find more front desk help. And during the meeting, I was like, listen, I like you very much, so I'm going to be straight with you. Can you spread a payment across 3 credit cards without forgetting how much goes on which one, remember which cat in the waiting room is vomiting and which one is here to get subcutaneous fluids, find that list of files the technicians asked you to pull half an hour ago and get them pulled, and send the refills Ms. Brueggemann called in to the pharmacy, all at the same time, without coffee because no one told Lori we were out and the delivery isn't coming until tomorrow, because that's what this job is. To have a child, you have to, at the very least, find someone to make it with you. I mean, doesn't that constitute some sort of unofficial screening process? Whenever I see someone dragging along a snot-nosed little tax deduction, I think, someone like that guy enough to let him pollinate her flower. He must be cool. No, I don't. I really think, I bet he only got 14 minutes of sleep last night. Thank the Lord I can't get pregnant. Or at least you have to get someone to sell you a bag of sperm. And that takes enough money to pay for it, and you probably have to fill out a bunch of paperwork and forms and background checks, too. But you don't have to do anything to prove you're worth a pet, and that makes our job totally ridiculous 82% of the time. Any old asshole can pick up a cat in the street or walk into a pet store and buy a sad puppy mill puppy. And as soon as they do, they call us, asking the kinds of questions that are often baffling to me. Now, I'm not going to get up on a soapbox because it probably couldn't support my weight. Not to mention, I am most certainly not the kind of person who does research before making a decision or a purchase. Everything I buy is an impulse purchase, be it a new flavor of sparkling water or a $1,000 computer. I get my clothes off the internet for fuck's sake. I am not risk averse. But yo, I wouldn't get a goldfish without at least asking the kid at PetSmart what kind of tank I had to buy for it and how much the food was going to cost and whether I had to find a doctor to take care of it. Not everyone is as lucky as I am to have seen the horrors of pet ownership up close and personal for a decade. But every day there's a situation that makes me drop all pretense of professionalism and hit some client with a bro, for real. A couple of years ago, we had a cat come in that had been run through a heat cycle in a dryer. Please listen to that sentence again. Listen to it again and imagine the type of person who would allow such a thing to happen. Can you picture it? Are you there yet? Perfecto. Now imagine answering his phone call as he described the practical joke that had gone wrong and the feeling in my stomach while listening to him try to explain what happened. Then multiply that feeling by 14 years and maybe you now have some insight into why my outlook is so dreary sometimes. We are exposed to human beings of the lowest common denominator, all day, every day, and this is a multi-million dollar, incredibly busy practice in the suburbs. It costs $60+ just to walk in the door. Once I sat, horrified, as a woman in our waiting room licked a kitten to clean it because she wanted it to feel like it was back with its mother. Another time, I watched a woman with long lacquered nails and an expensive-looking boob job eat a dog treat to see what it tasted like to her dog. You know, because human and canine taste buds are so similar. It's why I have a bowl of Purina One every morning in lieu of traditional oatmeal. And that was shortly after a different bird brain drank a little bit of her dog's diarrhea medication while Laura ran her credit card, quote, just to see if it worked, end quote. Listen, I put a lot of dumb shit in my mouth, but at least I have the decency to do it where no one can see me, like the time I smashed some sour cream and onion potato chips on half an old cheeseburger I found in the back seat of my car and wolfed it down behind a nightclub. I have seen people pay thousands of dollars for chemotherapy and rehabilitation and get acupuncture for their dogs and psychiatrists for their cats. I would have never understood the logic in that before, but now I get it. My first week was straight up shocking. I had no idea that people paid to have their dog's teeth cleaned. How would you even do that? Coax her into the chair, get her to lie back, strap the goggles on her, then hang a milk bone over her face so she holds her mouth open so you can get those molars clean? Now I know that you put a dog under general anesthesia and take a digital x-ray of its head, and Alyssa scales its good teeth while the surgeon on duty that day pulls out the bad ones. And the first time I ever stood next to the dental sink, watching it go down, I nearly passed out. Ultrasounds, neurology, dermatology, ophthalmology, radiation, cardiology, oncology? Man, who knew? When I was a baby, we had two dogs, one of whom remained chained to the garage due to bloodlust and unpredictability, while the other stayed inside with us and guarded my crib. I would fall over dead right now if you told me that either of those goofs had even had shots, let alone that my father had ever put one in his nice car to drive out to Buffalo Grove to get thousands of dollars worth of chemotherapy. I don't even think the outside dog got dog food, just milk and scraps of raw meat, which, with my current level of companion animal expertise, I would gently discourage my dad from feeding him. Things I've learned at my last job that might come in handy in a very specific set of circumstances at a new one. Don't give your dog Advil if you suspect he has a fever, and please refrain from giving him Imodium if he has a little diarrhea, especially if he has diarrhea because you thought he should have some of your burrito. Call your vet. And, while we're at it, stop diagnosing your pets at home. Take them to the doctor, unless you have a DVM license, in which case I'd like to see it. Walk your dog on a leash and keep your cat in the house. Every time I saw a dog that got beat up by a possum or a raccoon or a fox or a dingo, it made me want to choke slam somebody. Stop leaving chocolate and grapes and shit where your dog can get at them. And please, for the love of Doritos, put your weed away. Because at least once a month, a dog just houses its owner's stash. And while it's kind of hilarious, one, it makes your dog feel like crap, and two, loud is expensive. I mean, you really can't get a dog if you want to still live like a careless slob. I do. That's why I never got one. Sometimes I leave deliciously stinky underwear on the bathroom floor, or fall asleep with sushi next to the bed, or forget to tie the trash with the old pork chop bones in it up tight. All careless things that could lead to hundreds of dollars of treatment at my vet and a stern side eye from the staff at the front desk. I have seen dogs vomit socks, toys, jewelry, bottles, soap, and underwear. Put your things away already. Are digital pets a real thing yet? I saw Gone Girl. Go order a robot dog. Name your pet something reasonable that people who maybe aren't hip to the zeitgeist can spell and figure out. Yeah, I like Game of Thrones too, but that doesn't mean I'll be able to find your cat Daenerys Targaryen with ease in our computer system. Far be it from a woman with a cat named Helen Keller to criticize, but at least the average third grader could spell that. When Lord of the Rings was popping, we had a lot of Eowyns and Faramirs and Galadriels coming in for booster shots and heartworm tests. And I never read those books, ho. And these nerds would take it as a personal affront that I needed a hint at how to spell their dogs' names. Fine, tell me who Kizzy Reynolds is and then we'll talk. Just name it Wrigley like everyone else in Chicago. God. I am calm in a crisis, like the time that one dog got hit by a car right in front of us on the street, or the time that cat had a heart attack as her owner handed me her carrier. Once, after a dog was euthanized, we witnessed a funeral ritual in our office that I found surprisingly moving, even though I'm convinced that whatever spirits there happen to be, they're all in collusion against me. I've held a lot of scared hands, hugged a lot of people who bravely came alone to put their best friends down, and cried a lot of tears with people I don't really know, but I kind of do. Because as they neared the end, they were in the office every other week, or because I was there when Megan was pregnant with her first baby. He is now 10 years old, and his sister is 8, and they're on their second dog. Geez, where does the time go? I am also very dependable and incredibly loyal, which some might read as a lack of motivation to better myself or make anything other than a lateral move. But I was 22 when I started this job, and you know what? Sometimes it really is okay to just have a fucking job. Not a passion, not a career, but a steadfast source of biweekly income deposited directly into a checking account from which food and medicine and apps one totally forgot about having downloaded will be paid for. A job you are good at that makes you feel like you're doing something good in the world. I've had a life. I have been a dropout, a deadbeat, and a student. I have lived on Damon, on Central, on Hoyne, on Lunt, on Albion, then back to Lunt again. I've purchased 10 pairs of glasses, added at least a dozen trash tattoos, read hundreds of books, watched countless hours of television, lost old friends, made new ones, and had my heart broken approximately 289 times. I'm moving away, and it terrifies me to leave the one constant I've had in my entire life, but it's time to start a new chapter. So I need a new job, and I'm available to start immediately. Feelings are a mistake. I'm trying to adjust to living in a house where there is such a thing as a limit on screen time. This is a new concept for me. My original plan for once I'd made the move east on I-94 had been to get an office space or, in line with my misguided, unrealistic fantasy of myself as an artist, a studio space. The kind of place in which I would hang tapestries and burn sage sticks and surround myself with real artwork and plants. This is not the kind of person I have been so far in my life, one who clears energy. I just pushed the towers of books and trash on my desk aside to make room for my battered, gravy-splattered laptop and mine the cloud of negative energy above my head for material. My new fictional office involved an artful desk, the kind you'd find in a hip design magazine, and one of those computer monitors that's as big as a garage door and wholly unnecessary for someone who writes about scowling at nature on the internet. But in my pretend world, I also dabble in, web design, espionage, something that requires a big fancy monitor. In reality, I've scrolled through the listings for tiny office spaces in abandoned-looking buildings with the sole intention of escaping there to watch R-rated movies uninterrupted, ones with fucking and curse words. Then I wouldn't have to sit with my finger hovering over the pause button as I listened for tween-age footfalls banging down the hall to ruin the fun I've earned for staying alive this long. I want to eat room-temperature soup while watching entire seasons of The Real Housewives of New York, free of questions like, who is that? Or, why is this show interesting to you? I mean, I'm 137 years old. I can have screen time whenever I want. I bought 12 handheld computer devices and, yes, I absolutely must have them on my person at all times. I pay the internet provider so I can connect to all of the GIFs and memes I need. I stood by awkwardly as the gentleman from DirecTV connected these 2,469 channels. And sure, I'll probably be so busy watching a video on the laptop and listening to the new James Blake record on my phone that I'll forget about that CSI Miami marathon I wanted to watch on the True Crime channel. But it's worth $100 a month just to know that if I wanted to watch it, I could. Maybe I could put my headphones on and enjoy last week's episode of Black-ish on the iPad, despite the screen detox imposed on this house's smaller people. But can I really enjoy it when a floppy-haired ball of angst with preteen emotions is glaring at me over the top of the book his mother is forcing him to read? No, I cannot. This must be what it's like to grow up with siblings your own age. You did all your spelling homework and got moist, delicious cake after dinner, but your brother didn't, so his was followed by a side of jealousy and rage that he projects onto you and your delicious cake. And it stops tasting good because homeboy has leached the sweetness from it with his beady, resentful eyes. This is my life on Turn Off Those Cartoons and Read a Book Tuesday, or You Didn't Clean Your Room So the iPod Is Going on Top of the Refrigerator Sunday. Last Tuesday, there were friends over. I didn't even stop to ask who the little blonde heads belonged to as they whizzed past me, into our house, out of our house, pounding up the staircase to the second floor, thundering down another into the basement. There are too many of them, and everyone under the age of 27 looks alike to me, so why embarrass myself or them by confusing an Adeline with a Madeline when they don't give a shit about talking to me anyway? Whenever I hear the screen door slam shut, I cock my head for the indistinguishable cacophony of high-pitched squealing, then barricade myself and the cat in the nearest room full of boring adult shit, bank statements, topical analgesics, until they all run away to terrorize some unsuspecting neighbor's tranquil home. Beelzebub and I were sitting on the bed, debating whether to apply for a reverse mortgage, when I heard the unmistakable feedback of the karaoke machine, followed by a Taylor Swift song crackling through its tinny speakers. Moments later, three high-pitched voices warbled through the air conditioning vent. I nudged Helen awake. Should we waste a bunch of energy dragging all our shit downstairs, or do you want to just murder-suicide right here? She considered it for a few seconds, glancing warily around the room, her eyes coming to rest on a pair of recently laundered compression stockings hung out to dry on the back of a chair. She sighed. Is our enemy list up to date? I pulled a faded sheet of crumpled graph paper from where I'd hidden it deep within a dresser drawer and quickly added 543 names to it. Now it is. Help me find something sharp. Helen nodded toward the at-home blood pressure cuff propped up on the desk. Is that thing sharp? She smirked. Get out, I screamed. And she heaved herself off the bed and slowly lumbered down the stairs in search of the sharp knives we kept out of reach of tiny pink hands. Helen made her half-white flight pilgrimage first. I was out of town for a few days, I returned to find my dining room covered in shattered drywall after a radiator pipe had burst and partially collapsed the ceiling. I knew something was off as soon as I opened the door and was greeted by a surge of moist heat. My first thought was that I'd left a lean cuisine smoldering in the oven and that no one had noticed because I never replaced a battery in the carbon monoxide detector after it died 6 years ago. But then I rounded the corner to find Helen, coated in a fine layer of asbestos dust and glaring at me from next to the empty bag of food I had left for her to eat while I was away. I immediately threw her in a box and surveyed the ruined landscape. 80% of my considerable trash library was a warped, pulpy mess. There was condensation beaded on practically every surface. The clothes hanging in my walk-in closet were damp to the touch, and my lipsticks oozed wetly from their shiny cases. It was too overwhelming to even think about, so I didn't. After cutting some air holes in Helen's box, I hauled her down 3 flights of stairs, then stood on the curb googling, how many months can I skip paying rent over some straight-up bullshit while we waited for an Uber? After depositing the Antichrist in a dog-sized kennel at work, I went back to sort through the wreckage of my life. I'm pretty much a scorch-the-earth kind of dude, so I spent the night dragging bags of waterlogged pillows and damp clothes down to the dumpster. As I was attempting to dry my mattress with a neighbor's borrowed hairdryer, my landlord let himself in to tell me he'd shrug emoji, have some guys take a look in the coming week. Like there wasn't a giant hole in my fucking wall. Like the goddamn ceiling beams weren't goddamn exposed. Honestly, I'm not smart enough and this thing about my dead cat probably isn't the place to get into it. But what is life when you work 100 hours a week in order to live in a dump with a toilet that leaks shit water every time you flush? And the guy who cashes your uncomfortably large checks, which still don't feel quite right, considering the neighborhood you live in, looks at the child-sized hole in your wall and is like, wow, this sucks. Helen lived at the hospital for a few weeks while our decaying apartment was torn apart and put back together again. She loved it, man. The techs would just leave the cage door open and let her walk around like a queen, one who occasionally let her subjects pet her lustrous fur. Helen didn't give a fuck about dogs and would just sit there, daring them, as they were brought back for shots or treatment. She got really good at laying on stuff and rolling her eyes every time I walked past her perch to grab a box of HeartGuard or drop a urine sample in the lab. She was having as much of a blast as I imagine the King of Babylon can when forced to mingle with the mentally inferior inhabitants of Earth. While I was spending every night alone in my empty apartment, sitting in front of a television that had shorted out because it wasn't equipped to deal with jungle-like conditions, and still feeling kind of guilty about my miserable cat all alone in a cold, sterile cage. So I asked if Mavis wanted her in Michigan. "What is Michigan again?" Helen asked, eyeing the atlas I'd handed her warily. "It's beautiful. They have trees there, and squirrels for you to watch," I grasped for some enthusiasm. She turned her nose up at the idea that she could be bothered to pay attention to anything, let alone a squirrel. I tried again. "Apples? Deer?" Helen sighed grudgingly, then wrapped some catnip and a handful of salmon treats in a hobo bindle before demanding I carry her out to the car. She cheered up as soon as we hit Lakeshore Drive, emerging from her travel box to sniff cautiously at the lake breeze wafting in through the car windows. She sat on the armrest between us for the entire trip, alternately napping and shaking herself awake, solely to express her displeasure at the outfit I'd chosen for the drive. We pulled up to the house in the early evening, the sidewalk dotted with children playing as they waited for dinner. "I hate it here," Helen announced, peeking out the window at a girl jumping rope next door. "Take me back to the place where I know I can get good ribs." But she adjusted. The morning after we got there, she'd already peed on the welcome mat by the door, eaten 90% of the other cat's food, and was basking in the sunroom, chattering angrily at the birds who dared graze at the feeder hung outside the window. I sat on the couch, watching her perched on the chair she had sneezed on to mark as her own. I was thinking that Mavis and I could maybe pioneer a new type of marriage situation, one that some relationship expert would eventually dissect in The New Yorker. Mavis could continue to hang laundry on a line and churn her own butter in rural Michigan, and I would spend the days counting down to my early death in my dark, refrigerated Chicago apartment, scowling out my peephole at neighbors who made too much noise getting their groceries off the elevator. Mavis could keep picking her own blueberries to make jam under the blazing sun and knitting socks to sell at the Christmas bazaar in the church basement, while I could bankrupt myself ordering $17 cocktails at rooftop bars and waiting 4 hours for a brunch table downtown. We'd meet up occasionally to talk about married stuff. Oh, property taxes? Which big box retailer has the best deal on economy-sized containers of soup? And pretend we were still interested in having sex. Sounds like a dream, right? But oh no, fam. Apparently marriage involves a little thing called compromise, a concept of which I'd been previously unaware. For Mavis, this means having to wake up to a framed photo of Ice Cube on her bedroom wall. But for me, it apparently means giving up everything I ever loved. Everything here is dangerous and or irritating. Mosquitoes the size of a fist bite through my winter weight hoodie, I will never change, and leave itchy, egg-sized welts in their wake. Loud-ass frogs in our backyard pond croak all goddamn night. Bats flap their leathery wings hysterically while trapped in the wood stove. Squirrels in the branches over the deck hurl walnuts at our heads maniacally as we grill farm-stand corn for lunch. Sick raccoons fall out of trees. Fat groundhogs chew through the fence to snack on the okra and tomatoes I refuse to help harvest. And young cats disembowel field mice and leave them in the middle of the dining room at dawn. Gas is 37 cents a gallon. You can buy shoes at the grocery store. The farmer's market is full of actual farmers instead of bearded hipsters in distressed flannel pontificating about peak asparagus season. This week on Americana Horror Story. But the serpent of old was learning to love her new life, or at least pretend to love it, just to spite me, whenever Mavis hovered nearby to get a picture of her to post on Instagram. By the time I packed my good cassoulet pan and a bag of assorted sensible cotton briefs and joined them in the Wolverine state, it seemed that Helen had adjusted quite nicely, mastering the art of intimidating the other cats with a punishing look, and learning to use stairs for the first time in 8 years relatively quickly. After a couple of weeks of giving me the cold shoulder, she busted open the door to my bedroom and sat at my feet, demanding to be picked up and placed on my pillow. "Are you happy that I'm here?" I asked tentatively, after she placed her moist butthole right on the spot where my eye had recently been. "LOL, no." "Of course you're not." I shoved her off the bed and started counting the 29 assorted vitamins and medicines I have to take every morning. "Why did you even bother coming in here?" "I enjoy watching you suffer." "Hey, did you know that these people eat 3 different vegetables with every meal? Also, they don't consider milkshakes a food group. You could learn a lot by following their example." and she sashayed out of the room with her tail swishing lazily behind her and an unidentified human finger between her teeth. I have followed their example, okay? Under Helen's mockingly watchful eye, I started doing healthy things like eating roasted cauliflower and deciding to read a book even though there is a television in the room. Which brings us back to my newest adversary, days with a limit on screen time. Helen doesn't care. I mean, she's a goddamn cat, so why should it matter if I'm 2 weeks behind on Queen Sugar? I've learned that every child in the neighborhood can feel a television's electromagnetic waves from 3 blocks away and will wander into the room on some, hey, what you watching shit, just as it reaches a crucial point in the episode. But then she bit a kid. I didn't even see it coming until it was too late. 1 minute we were settled on the pointless couch in the room with no TV, watching as tan legs and postage stamp size shorts whizzed past us to grab pre-cut vegetables and other snacks at the bottom of the food pyramid from the kitchen. And the next, Helen was pressed into the couch's corner with her ears flattened against her head. I tossed the book I was pretending was an episode of Survivor on the floor, hooked my hands under 2 scentless armpits, and lifted Madison, out of harm's way, only to be caught off guard when Helen latched onto my arm instead. After I wrestled my arm away, we sat looking at each other for a second, her eyes angry and mine surprised, my blood smeared across the tiny patch of white on her chin. "What has gotten into you?" I asked as what sounded like an entire 3rd grade trampled up the stairs to get away from her. Helen responded by bear-hugging the smooth, slender ankle of a mom who'd just arrived to collect her Caitlin and plunging her teeth into the softest part. Later that night, at midnight, Helen and I were sitting alone in an exam room at the emergency vet. The harsh yellow lights overhead made the cat hair stand out in sharp relief against my faded black hoodie and pajama pants. Helen, in her carrier on the table across from me, was seething. It had taken snow boots, 2 pairs of fireplace gloves, 3 old towels, and a folding chair to trap her in the hard plastic case. The doctor entered shaking an X-ray, disconcertingly cheerful considering the time of night and the severity of my situation. Maybe he was nervous. He told me that Helen's chest cavity was small, I know, and her lungs were constricted, and her heart was abnormally small, for sure. And while none of that explained why she'd lost her shit, fainted, then rose up to launch herself in my general direction again, it definitely was the reason for her labored breathing and a possible cause of her emotional breakdown. Helen snorted at that. The doctor droned on about her poor quality of life, how she had suffered from a URI and a compromised immune system since she was born, how I might have to chase her down and put her in a headlock every day to force Prozac into her, how he couldn't guarantee that her behavior would ever go back to normal. I started adding up all my credit card balances in my head, trying to calculate how much I was willing to pay for this cat. Well, why don't we start with... I'm ready to die, Helen interrupted, tapping the bars of the cage. Get the paperwork ready. I want the shot. The doctor excused himself and left us alone. Well, that was abrupt. She rolled her perpetually leaky eyes. It's embarrassing seeing you wash kale and floss your teeth every day. I don't want to go back to that. If I don't die now, I definitely will after another week of your natural deodorant and wholesome family entertainment. I was watching porn this morning on my phone, I scoffed. She started making slashing motions across her throat. Fine. Do you want a hug or something before I go? Almost imperceptibly, Helen moved her head to the left. Not a nod, but not a nod. I unlocked the carrier. She stepped dubiously onto the table, then climbed down into my lap. I hadn't held her since she was a little baby. Every time I've moved to lay a hand on her in anything even resembling an affectionate way, I have been met with everything from mild resistance to misdemeanor assault. I felt her relax in my arms, her body warm and liquid, and I patted her head with the tip of my index finger. She closed her eyes and rested her head gently against my mangled and oozing arm. I tried to remember whether I had brought with me to Michigan the old bottle of amoxicillin from when I'd gotten my tooth pulled. I stroked Helen's back and heard the faint rumble of a purr coming up from her throat. Our fever dream was broken by a knock at the door. The enthusiastic Grim Reaper popped his head in, asking, "We all good here?" Helen dug her rear claws into my thigh, and I would have body slammed her to the ground if Homeboy hadn't been watching. Instead, I shoved her as nicely as possible onto the chair next to me and smiled while cursing that asshole back to hell, all the while reaching for the clipboard so I could give him permission to send her there. A technician came in with a portable credit card machine, and we all stood around as the chip reader took approximately 47 awkward minutes to process my payment. The tech left, and Helen Keller gave me a sour look. "Thank you for being my Annie Sullivan, I guess," she said as I put my wallet back in my bag and shrugged into my coat. I helped her back into her carrier and lingered near the door. She had sneezed a huge glob of mucus onto my pants. "You want me to, read a few stanzas of the Rainbow Bridge off my phone or something?" I asked, one hand on the doorknob, again with the eye rolling. "Well, you're the lesbian." I snatched the door open. "LOL, bye." I cried all the way to the 24-hour grocery store and ate half a rotisserie chicken in the parking lot. It was the tribute she would have wanted. We are never meeting in real life. It's a sweaty, balmy night circa 2002. Probably, definitely around 1 a.m. It's the witching hour, with 59 minutes until the lights come on and you can realize that you're just not into the person you spent the whole night shout-talking to. I'm in the basement at Cinnabar, lurking next to the bar, trying to order myself another Jameson, because that's what I like. Or maybe that's what I want people to think I like. I'm not even sure I had a personality back then. I just tried to haphazardly arrange other people's projections and shit I thought was cool into something captivating. Meeting people in public with the idea that they might want to get my underpants off has always been difficult, because I'm fat and bars are too loud and crowded and dark for me to just pull out 250 out-of-context pages of the YA novel I've been working on for years to try to impress some dude I want to fuck. I've spent a lifetime glaring at dance floors full of people who didn't splash on cologne and pay $20 to get into the club to meet someone interesting. Jameson in hand, I tip the bartender and am about to drink the whole thing on the spot. I hate getting bumped into at the club when I feel someone sidle up next to me and put a hand on my drinking arm. "Oh, hey, it's you," I say to this stranger, which is one of many reasons that I would rather die than make a person's actual acquaintance. This need to fuck every human interaction up with a jolt of disconcerting awkwardness. It catches him off guard, I can tell. He recovers quickly and asks what I'm drinking. He chokes back a laugh when I tell him, because no one wants to make a $9 investment in a weird idiot who oozes discomfort and wore her dad's New Balances to a nightclub. My dude is already in too deep to turn back now, however, so he orders one for me and another for himself, and I reconsider my decision to pass on the bread basket at dinner. I have approximately 6 sips until I become relatively incoherent, but the music is loud, so I can blame it on the DJ. Homeboy ushers me to a secluded corner of the room and toasts the drink in my left hand while I drink from the one in my right before launching into a soliloquy about all the cool shit he does that makes him sexy. I am right there with him. I am almost ready to take home a copy of his mixtape and listen to it for real when he says, "You came in with the girl in the purple, right?" "Right." "Yo, that girl is beautiful. Do you know if she's into slam poetry?" And since the tiny lime-slicing knives behind the bar are too dull to effectively cut my wrists open along the vein, I choose to attempt suicide the old-fashioned way, listening to a hot dude who doesn't want to fuck me ask a bunch of questions about the friend I came here with. I chug my whiskey in the hopes that my death from alcohol poisoning will be immediate and painless. This exchange typifies 98% of my former social life, and you know what I've realized? I spent too much time trying to mold myself to fit the romantic ideals of humans who prove themselves unworthy of that effort, and I regret it. Never again will I be with someone who is unwilling to accept me as I am, or who has any desire to mold me into something that makes me uncomfortable. Mostly this is because I'm too anxious and overwhelmed to meet new people and try to make my interests sound more fun. I have unsuccessfully tried to be a girl who is into obscure collage. I have unsuccessfully tried to be a girl who is into the electronic music that just sounds like a bunch of bleeps and bloops. I have unsuccessfully tried to be a girl who reads graphic novels and experimental fiction and David Foster Wallace. I have stayed up late watching bootleg kung fu movies on shitty laptops. I have grimaced through expensive meals that were little more than adorable art projects on a plate. I have shivered in an icy stadium seat, cheering for a team I have no stake in, and I have cooked lobsters, which I don't like, for someone who wouldn't dare eat a burger from McDonald's, which I do. Before I gave up on life and meeting people in public, I used to let my friends set me up on blind dates, mostly because I hate myself. I don't really feel alive unless I'm actively wishing I was dead. This is how your friend, who loves you, sets you up on a blind date. First, she browbeats her boyfriend into exhaustively scrolling through the mental Rolodex of every man he's ever worked for, talked to, or shared an elevator with until he can come up with one who has a job, isn't married, and might be convinced to eat dinner across from a woman she's only willing to describe as very smart and super funny, with an amazing personality. Then, she forces you to cannonball into the middle of the dating ocean holding an inner tube with no flippers or oxygen tank. And I appreciated the consideration. I really did. It warmed my cold, dead heart every single time I got blindsided by people who had no idea what they were in for and had a difficult time masking their disappointment. I really did want to tug on a Spanx and sit awkwardly across from that dude your husband met in the grocery store parking lot after he backed into your guy's Volvo, who just broke off his engagement, and blather on about television shows he pretends to never have heard of over a plate of mid-priced pasta. Yes, please. Sign me right up. Oh, how I love to fatfish the unsuspecting. This is why the internet is a miracle. I mean, I don't care about watching real-life murders on the dark web or angrily tweeting at CNN anchors, but it is a magical thing that I can just open up my computer and cultivate superficial relationships with people who may or may not have stolen their profile picture from